Good evening. Can you all? Yes, you can all hear me. It does work. Welcome. My name is Helena Kennedy, and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College. And it's lovely to see all of you here tonight. It's a special evening for us for a number of reasons. And first of all, because we have joining us as an honorary fellow, Sir John Beddington, who is the chief scientist of our country. And you can imagine that that has been a great source of pleasure to us here at Mansfield College. So John is the chief scientific advisor to the government. He's a professor of applied population biology at Imperial College London. And he is coming to Oxford to a number of different roles. And we're looking forward to having him as part of our community too. John was someone that I watched from a distance because suddenly there were things that he was producing that linked in to concerns of mine. And so, for example, at the beginning of this year, he published a paper which was actually looking at changing identities and raised some of those issues that have concerned me about the way in which you have to balance individual rights and liberties against privacy and security. And it's a very, very interesting report called Future Identities. And he discusses in that paper how the internet is actually changing people's lives and the nature of their identity. But he's done many different things and in fact is recognised as having been a really, really successful chief scientific advisor. He was originally appointed by Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister and succeeded Sir David King. And then he's been kept on and remained in position right up until now with the coalition government. And he's going to retire somewhat later this year, I think probably the end of next month, and we're hoping that we will see much more of him here at the college and in Oxford generally. John, would you please step up? On one of these occasions, I want you to come and give one of these talks on a Friday night about your very interesting life. But it's wonderful that you're joining us, and we feel really honoured. It's great. Do you want to say just a few words?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think I arguably have an absurd job, because my job is I'm responsible for all science and engineering in the United Kingdom, which is clearly mad. Nobody can do this. I also have a curious reporting line, which actually is Deloitte, because my reporting line is directly to the Prime Minister and to the Cabinet Secretary, which means I can do anything I want, because neither David Cameron nor Sir Jeremy Haywood are actually looking at their watch and thinking, what the hell is Beddington doing on a Friday afternoon? They are, I have to say, largely indifferent to my activities, which is actually rather a nice thing to be in, a nice position to be in. But to be slightly more serious, thank you very much. This is a significant honour. I'm actually retiring in on the 31st of March, so my successor, Sir Mark Walford, we'll be taking it up on the 1st of April, which I am not so...
poor fool.
And so I gave a talk at the Royal Society about a week ago about emergencies and the terrible catastrophes that can happen to the world. You know, you can have a space weather, some emission from the sun attacking us, the space weather, you might have a new pandemic of infectious diseases, or you might have yet another volcano going off in Iceland and closing down our air traffic. And so I amuse myself by looking at the frequency of these events. And having done that, I then calculated the chance that Mark would actually do a five-year term without having one, at least one of them happening. And this is less than 5%. So the 1st of April is the day of taking up his position, would seem to me entirely appropriate. Right. So being more safe, thank you so much for this honour.
A little announcement before I move to the next part of this delightful evening. And I wanted to tell you that this week on the Melvyn Bragg programme on a Thursday morning, we had one of our fellows, Professor Blundell, taking part. And I knew it was going to happen, and I especially stayed in to listen before I headed off for my day. and it was absolutely fantastic. So I recommend you all to go to your computers, summon it up, and listen to it, because it's an amazing account about freezing and freezing points and the freezing of things. And it was the sort of thing that I would never have imagined myself being absolutely absorbed by, but I was, and it was great. Thank you very much, Stephen, it was wonderful. So please take the opportunity of going to see that. Now, it's my great honour to introduce to you Leslie Woodhead. Leslie Woodhead is, I think, probably one of the greatest living documentary makers. How about that?
It's about living.
Yes, certainly living in this country. And you can look and see the amazing films and documentaries he's made in his life. And the one that I almost got him to talk about tonight, but I'm saving it so that when we actually do launch the Institute of Human Rights, it will be one of the things that we will have in the early stages of that, because he made a film called Cry from the Grave, and it was about Srebrenica and the terrible massacre in Srebrenica. And it was one of the most remarkable films that you could see. Shocking, moving, and hugely informative, but also it said so much about how we had to have a different kind of legal and a different kind of order to deal with conflict, and it has been very, very influential. And I know that it's been watched by the military. We showed it in the House of Lords, and many people from the world of defence came and looked at it and drew lessons from it. It won prizes all over the world. And although Leslie is a recipient of many prizes in his lifetime, I think that that was the kind of, if you like, one of the pinnacles of your career. And it's still, there's now a memorial sort of building in Srebrenica, which is to commemorate the death there, and a short version of a film that Leslie made subsequently is there as part of the kind of memorialising of the terrible events. And Leslie was the person who contributed, who's made that possible. So, but tonight it's something different. When Leslie was young, he was a great, I was already making films and for television, and he got to be in the cavern when the Beatles were playing there and filmed them. And in fact, I've seen photographs of him filming the Rolling Stones and so on. So back then, in the 60s and 70s, he was doing a very different genre of filmmaking. And the interesting thing is that it's made it possible for him to write his recent book, which you'll have seen outside, but also he's made a documentary about the way in which the Beatles created change in the Soviet Union. And so I'm going to invite you tonight, Leslie. Thank you for coming. It's wonderful that you're here. Please come and give us your talk.
Turning up on this horrible night. This bizarre territory, I can remember, I can date it precisely when it came into my life, which is a night in August 1962. I was at that time a very raw... A very raw researcher at Granada Television in Manchester, not long come down from Cambridge, with very little idea what I was doing. I was working on a series of little two-minute films about contrasts in the northwest of England, like, you know, the last clockmaker in Oldham, to be contrasted with a young man who was designing frocks in a terrace street in Pennine Village. And it was decided that we should do one on musical changes. We filmed with the Brighouse Brass Band in Brighouse, 16 men of brass. And then I was asked to find what was the thing most unlike this in our area. a young fellow researcher, very much more plugged in than me. He said, I know what. I gather there's these guys, young guys in Liverpool who are making a bit of a storm. They haven't made any records yet, but everybody thinks they're going to do something. Ring up a man called Brian Epstein and see what he says. So I called up Brian Epstein. He said, come and meet me in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool on a Sunday evening, which is an occasion I shall not forget. I sat there in the lobby of the Adelphi thinking, well, it can't be him. Here's this guy with a three-piece suit, looks very, very posh. He looks the least rock and roll person I've ever seen in my life. But after about half an hour, I went across and made myself known to him and said, are you by any chance Brian Epstein? He said, I am indeed. Come and meet the boys. So we wandered through the streets of Liverpool into this sweaty cellar, and it's something I can remember to this day. The noise came up the stairs through the soles of my feet and into my guts, and it was the Beatles who were on stage being amazing. I mean, it wasn't my music. I'm a modern jazz fan. My father had been a dance band musician, but this wasn't my kind of thing at all. But it was totally electrifying. And I said, well, can we come and film? So he said, yeah, come back in and do one of the lunchtime sessions. So I went into the pub with the Fab, the soon-to-be Fab Four, and I'll never forget Paul McCartney. He said, it must be dead glamorous working in television. which I thought was, I said, well, I think what you're doing is pretty interesting as well. And they were the kind of smart, sharp-looking one, who turned out to be John Lennon, obviously was eyeing me up as a possible route to getting the group on television. And we came back a few and did this lunchtime session a short while after. It was Ringo's first ever time of playing with the band, so I was surrounded by people saying, we want Pete, get out, Ringo, we hate you, and all of that. But anyway, we filmed it. We then couldn't leave because they said there are anti-Ringo fans up there in the street that'll beat you to bits if you go up, so you need protection. Eventually we got out. It's another story. Eventually we couldn't show the film because the Brighouse band were going to cost us MU rates, which would have crippled the budget for the program for a month. So the film stayed on the shelf. I chased the Beatles around Manchester clubs and eventually persuaded, when Epstein got very fed up about the non-appearance of the film, persuaded the producer to let the Beatles come in the studio and do their first ever TV there. And the film wasn't shown until a week later. There I thought it would have ended. What I didn't know is that this little film and this encounter has woven through my life for the next 50 years. And it remains astonishing to me that that headline looks like the craziest hyperbole, hippie bombast, who could believe that, I discovered to be no more than the literal truth. It's even odder in that the Beatles were always hugely illegal, never allowed, never began to be allowed to play in the former Soviet Union, despised, derided, described as ape music and all of that. But I then discovered over the years that, and this is what I'll talk about this evening, and I'll show some extracts from film, really helped to be a catalyst for change. In a society where it was obviously difficult for people to express political opposition, and culture was always a very powerful motor for promoting change, always had been. Soviet artists had always used various cultural avenues to look askance at what the regime was doing and so forth. I also discovered that this tiny little film that I made was enormously famous in Eastern Europe, and everybody had seen it, which just struck me as utterly extraordinary. I still don't quite know to this day how that could have happened or how they could have even seen it. But when I saw the Beatles' major fan in Leningrad, who I met in, I think, 2006, he said, "Did you ever see that little film?" And I said, "Well, yeah, actually, I made it." "Great man," he said, huge hug. So what I'd like to do is to begin by showing a short extract from a film I made for BBC Four with the same title. Here we go. Now the Beatles rock the Kremlin.
In August 1962, I made a little film with four unknown kids in a Liverpool cellar. Soon, the Beatles had conquered much of the world. But back in the USSR, the repressive old men in the Kremlin tried to resist the Fab Four. They were defeated by their children. This is the untold story of how the Beatles helped to destroy communism.
While in the West, the Beatles stepped on all the rules. The 60s beat was echoing through all the Soviet schools.
The Beatles turned tens of millions of young people into another religion. And the understanding that we are living in a monster state and we needed an alternative.
Every Russian schoolboy wants to be a star, playing Beatles music, making a guitar.
They changed everything and they opened the whole world. It was all brought by them, by the Beatles.
И спасибо Beatles, которые внесли свою посильную лепту в развал этой империи.
The teachers looked upon all this as if it were a sin. We were building communism, but the Beatles bought it in.
They destroyed the communism. More than Gorbachev, by the way. They changed the Soviet Union.
Beatles, it was the key that open door to the West culture. West culture produced cultural revolution. Cultural revolution destroy Soviet Union.
Even Comrade Brezhnev sadly shook his head. Each comrade's child was in a band. Yeah, yeah, virus swept the land. Yeah, yeah, virus swept the land. Things were getting out of hand.
But the first hole in the Iron Curtain, the songs of Beatles.
The Beatles were always looked upon as very dangerous, bourgeois, somehow undermined in the system itself.
And what could they do? What could they say? A generation gone astray.
The Beatles, it was like a fresh air. In Russia, it was amazing power because they had this free spirit.
Слушали эту музыку и спасали. Переставали быть рабами совка. Вот чего они боялись.
It was Beatles generation.
Beatles, 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 Beatles. Da!
That's a film I made for BBC Four a couple of years back, which really kind of covers the territory that I'll try and talk about this evening. It, I now need to back up into the other ingredient in why I got obsessed with this. I'm a child of the Cold War in every way. I can remember going to bed actually it's about 10 days after the Beatles' first record was issued, Love Me Do, with the Cuban, the teeth of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Unsure, genuinely unsure whether I was going to wake up in the morning. That was not exaggerated. It was a real terror. And the Cold War with the superpowers sort of pawing the ground and growling at one another, with the Berlin Wall splitting the world, really shaped my life in every way until, well, obviously the beginning of the 90s. This was reflected in the next little clip I'd like to show you, which is what I found myself doing during my national service. I was the last generation who had to do compulsory national service, so I buckled down and did it with deep reluctance before I went to Cambridge. And this is a little thing just about what then happened. Thanks, Ron.
It began in the mid-1950s, when, like 2 million other young men, I was conscripted to do 2 years national service. But then something odd happened. I was recruited to become a foot soldier in the intelligence battalions, a Russian linguist, an apprentice spy, I suppose. Over the 1950s, as the Cold War intensified, 5,000 of us joined the ranks of JSSL, the Joint Services School for Linguists.
And the personnel selection officer said, "I see you both applied for the Russian course. Now, you may think this is a skive, but in fact, it's a very serious choice. If you're trained as a Russian interpreter, you may find yourself at any moment dropped by parachute behind enemy lines."
You were pitchforked straight into Russian, and you walked down the hill and walked into a room, and there was a small man who spoke to you in a language that you knew was completely strange and started to show you the alphabet. And you went from there.
I can't remember the word for it now, but I always remember rolling barrage, that we'd learned the Russian for rolling barrage. I didn't know what a rolling barrage was. I had a notion of it, it was something that rolled. I didn't realize it was guns, you know, laying down carpet shells. I thought it was some sort of juggernaut. But anyway, you'd learn these lists of things which you'd no idea what they were.
Well, that's what I did for 2 years, finished up listening in on Soviet pilots in Berlin before the wall was built. In ways that I didn't expect, these two formative experiences, Beatles in the Cavern Club and being taught Russian by the RAF, came together for how the Beatles rocked the Kremlin. The experience of being taught Russian, which was just kind of annoying at the time. All I wanted to do was to get to university, but the beautiful noise of the Russian language, and indeed something of the culture, we were taken to A-level in about six months and read Pushkin and God knows what else, alongside learning My Undercarriages Down and Locked. Which is not much good to me. Of course, I've forgotten all of it now, but for a while it was very intense. I was in Berlin. We had nothing else to do except listening on those Soviet pilots. And when I eventually began to work in television in 61, I really had an absolute longing to go and look at this world that I'd been listening in on over the years of my national service. But for a long time, it was simply impossible. It was a young man who'd had espionage training, as they would have regarded it, was hardly a safe bet to go into that part of the world. And it wasn't until, I think I first went to one of the Soviet satellites in the late 70s to do a film about a Polish dock workers' strike, which took me to Gdansk and Szczecin and the Baltic ports. And I also made films meeting kind of creepy dissidents in parks away from eavesdropping machines in Czechoslovakia and in Yugoslavia. But never in Russia. I couldn't even get a visa. So that remained whatever Churchill called it, an enigma wrapped in a mystery. It was unvisitable. It remained closed for all those reasons for a long time. The next kind of formative thing for me was meeting a man called Artemy Troitsky. Art Troitsky is an astonishing man. He's become my protector, my guide, my kind of enabler, and now a very good friend. He turned up in that opening clip there in that white t-shirt. You'll see a bit more of him later. Art Troitsky is the kind of Bob Geldof of the Soviet Union. He has ridiculously, courageously opposed the regime through his obsession with rock and roll. And his contacts in that world are quite extraordinary. And he became the man who introduced me to that world. I first met Art in London in 1988. He'd come to promote a book he'd written called Back in the USSR about what he calls the curious disease of Soviet rock and roll. He, extremely stylish, highly intelligent, very charismatic guy. I remember we had lunch in a Thai restaurant in London, and he told me that he was really disappointed to be in London, having been bought an air ticket by his publisher, because he'd hoped to escape the Soviet Union in a hot air balloon. So that was a bit distressing for him. But anyway, he was there, and he said to me something that completely galvanized me. He said, you need to understand that the Cold War was not won by nuclear weapons. It was won by the Beatles. I thought, what? He said, no, I'm telling you, the Beatles had a far more profound impact on stitching, dissolving the foundations of authoritarianism in the Soviet Union than any nuclear threats, which just didn't impinge on real people. Anyway, he said, come to Moscow, and I'll show you how, I'll introduce you to some of this. And of course, by then, in the in 87-88, Gorbachev was in power. And for the first time, it became possible to go and have a look without being sort of hoiked out by some ghoul at immigration. So off I went to meet up with Art in Moscow in the winter of 88. He opened every door, but he also interestingly told me a lot about how we got to here, what had been going on that had brought this this situation where now, by the late 80s, Soviet rock and roll was really the soundtrack of Gorbachev's perestroika. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of rock and roll bands in Moscow by then, and as Art said, every one of them, without exception, was inspired and enabled by the Beatles, even though the Beatles were never allowed to play here. So this became kind of seriously interesting to me, and I began to think, you know, what can I do about that? I'd love to make a documentary about this. Art also took me through some understanding of the weird standoff between popular music and the state over the years, well, since the revolution, basically. It's a wacky story. Being a musician in the Soviet Union from, especially from the late 20s, from when Stalin was in the driving seat, was, I think, an utterly crazy experience. The Kremlin changed its line on popular music every month, and you never knew what the line would be. One week you would be lionized as a hero of the Soviet Union, and the next week you'd be in the gulag. and you couldn't read the winds of how Stalin would, you know, would feel about all of that. It got more and more complicated because once another revolution had begun on the other side of the world, jazz in New Orleans, this was a difficulty for the controllers of musical culture in the Soviet Union, because jazz was, after all, evolved by the toiling black masses of America, and therefore was kind of okay. We were happy with that. It was politically acceptable. So Stalin decided that there was a good jazz, which was the toiling black version, and a corrupted jazz, which was the stuff that was going on in North America, outside the South. Of course, what he didn't know is that nearly all the jazz that was being made in New York, Chicago, was being made by toiling black men who'd migrated to the North. So they struggled with that, and it became, for the musicians who tried to cope with this insane, flickering, endless change, it became an uphill, it became very, very difficult. And that continued really and went on being as whimsical until Stalin died in 52. And then the dam broke. The pent-up frustrations of those generations they began to thaw in the same way as Khrushchev enabled. And there were a couple of seminal events. One was that the very first hippie movement flourished in Moscow, particularly from the early 50s. There was an outfit of very seditious youths called the Stilyagi, the style setters, who dressed like, I mean, they modeled their style on Tarzan. One of the films that escaped the censors was Tarzan in the City. And apparently was read, Art told me, by the Stilyagi as, it's about Tarzan swinging through the streets, a free man, as though he were in the jungle. And they read that as an incitement to be free in the city. And they renamed Gorky Street in central Moscow as Broadway, and they drank cocktails, and they wore, you know, ridiculous outfits, scandalizing, calculated to scandalize their parents. They wouldn't do any work, they'd finish up chucked in prison and so forth, but they were ludicrously brave and kept on, you know, fighting the good fight. The big heroes were Louis Armstrong and Glenn Miller. And their anthem was Chattanooga Choo Choo. I mean, it's just all so wild. They majored in very lurid big ties with bathing beauties painted on them. They became quite a thing. They were finally enveloped by an early Khrushchev initiative. In 57, Khrushchev invited the youth of the world to an international youth festival. And people really did come from all over the planet, particularly from America, which was an astonishing moment for Soviet kids. Suddenly they had, you know, they had rock and roll people, they had, you know, seditious poets and every kind of cultural envoy who swamped into Moscow. And there are people who I've talked to who still remember this as a moment. It only lasted 2 weeks, but it was completely transformative. And Art Troitsky is very interesting about this. He says, you know, this was a time where, as he puts it thrillingly, it was cool to be a Soviet. And this was because it was around the time that Yuri Gagarin flew into space. They were leading the world. Khrushchev had said, "We will bury America. We're gonna win," and it looked like they might. And so there was a high sense of euphoria and possibility at this time. And right in the middle of all of this landed another rich curiosity, which was Chubby Checker's "Let's Twist Again," like we did last summer, an artless, kind of brain-dead two-minute song, which totally blew the Soviet kids away. They loved Chubby Checker. Khrushchev loathed Chomichev, but he couldn't stamp it out. And the enormous popularity, there were Soviet versions of Let's Twist Again. There's one called Sailor, You've Been Sailing Too Long, sung to the tune of Twist, Twist and Churn. This passion for Chubby Checker and Twist Again, like I did last summer, inspired something utterly bizarre, which is that because there were no, very few available records, and certainly no rock and roll at all, the Soviet kids invented a way around this, which was they took the little recording booths on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, where so lonely soldiers could record messages for their mums on little kind of vinyl discs, and they bootlegged stuff from Radio Luxembourg and from the BBC and inscribed it on the only vinyl they could find, which were X-ray plates of Uncle Sergei's lungs. So most of the early rock and roll finished up on X-ray plates, snaffled from hospitals. It's utterly bizarre. And we'll see a bit of that in a minute in my next clip. So this moved into the 60s with the Khrushchev's liberations spilling into an enablement and a permissiveness for far more freedom for rock and roll. And the next person who Art introduced me to is a guy called Kolya Vasin, who, as he says, is a man of good heart and Russia's ultimate Beatles fan. Let's have a look at Kolya in this next extract. One scene never forgotten. Here it comes.
Kolya Vasin is Russia's ultimate Beatles fan.
Adventures. Beatles gave me adventures all my life.
For more than 40 years, he's been building his John Lennon Temple of Love in St. Petersburg.
То есть они меня возбудили, понимаешь? Это было колоссально.
Music!
Как будто началась другая жизнь. Another life. With the Beatles, another life. Моя душонка детская, вот тогда, когда мне было 18 лет, когда первый услышал Beatles, она вылетела на свет. Я начал летать. Flying with the Beatles. Я полюбил Beatles. Они стали моими друзьями, братьями по духу.
Since 1964, when he first heard a bootleg Beatles tape, Kolya Vasin has been amassing his hoard of Beatles treasure.
Для меня это спасение души, а не балдеж, не торч, не там времяпрепровождение, не хобби какое-то, понятно. My Temple стал как бы результатом всего этого. Я боялся этого, я действительно боялся. И вся моя жизнь прошла при совке в страхе. Потому что, я повторяю, было колоссальнейшее давление пропаганды. Они так поливали Битлов, так обижали нашу любимую группу, что я боялся за себя, что вот если я что-нибудь скажу за Битлз, меня могут арестовать.
For Kolya Vasin and millions of other kids, it was never easy to be a Beatles fan in the Soviet Union. Reviled by the communist authorities as Western pollution, Beatles records were banned. Vigilantes patrolled the streets, rounding up rock and roll fans and shaving off their long hair. Police at airports kept a lookout for smuggled records.
You just bring it into the country, actually. It's like contrabanda, you know, just you bring in this album knowing you're not supposed to bring this stuff into the country. So, and they will find it in your luggage. They will scratch it. And it was devised like three nails together, you know, just to scratch it, because it should be done in a proper way.
Official Soviet culture ignored the Beatles' invasion, preferring accordions and folk dancing to guitars and the Fab Four.
You know, being a young, a radical man, I just hated all this because it was all totally square, totally uncool. All the singers had wrong haircuts. They were dressed like office clerks and they sang like Brezhnev at the Communist Party Congress. Soviet culture has been totally unsexy, very rigid, too limited. There was nothing bright and free and funky and sexy and funny about it. And of course, these qualities were exactly the vitamins that our bodies needed.
So that's my man, that's Artur Ensky. He said wonderfully of that Soviet culture, I remember the first time I met him, he said, there was nothing in it that reminded me of my dreams. Marvelous thought, but he found ways to get there. So Collier went about his business, building his temple, being, you know, heavily in great difficulties and always in danger of being arrested, but managed to skid around the edges of things mostly. He got dragged around the streets by his hair a couple of times, but he seemed to be able to live with that. But alongside all of those repressions, some kids were making their own rock and roll. They had to, there were no guitars, there were no strings, there were no electric, there were no amplifiers, so they got involved with wild improvisations. They sawed up their grandma's kitchen table to make the body of the guitar. They stole strings from pianos. They discovered that it was possible to make an amplifier by raiding public call boxes and taking it out of the handset in the public call box, which apparently literally shut down half the call boxes in Moscow and St. Petersburg. There were just no working phones for a bit. So they improvised wildly, and slowly an underground home-built rock and roll culture was evolved. Art introduced me to a man called Andrei Makarevich. One of the interesting things about the Soviet rock kids is that they were all, or almost all, the sons of privilege. Their parents were architects or, you know, artists of some kind, because of course they were the parents who could travel and could bring the music back to them. It's very unlike the evolution in the Western world, where there were, you know, often working class or less. But Andrei Makarevich, who Art introduced me to, fell preposterously in love with the Beatles and just stopped doing everything except learn how to be a Beatle with his homemade guitar. And he and a few chums sat around in there at home, plunking away for years, actually. He said it looked easy, and then we discovered it's really, really not easy. But Andre built a group called Time Machine, who remain to this day the biggest rock band in Russia. So they've lasted for, you know, 40 years, Andre and Time Machine. And it worked for him, I think, with his fans, because he was always illegal, never paid a penny, lived on the edges of legality. His concerts were never advertised, it was word of mouth. So the band would just turn up and loads of kids would find it. It's like a kind of early internet thing. I mean, I always thought, you know, looking at Andre's life as an early rock and roller, in some ways it's a kind of louche, edgy existence that many a Western rock star would have admired. The sedition of it, the edginess of it, the fact that they were not owned by anybody. They couldn't be, they weren't being paid anything. And his story, it's a long story, and it goes on to the stairs, as I said, but it has the most wonderful ending. Finally, in the 90s, by which time Time Machine were simply enormous, his producer arranged for them to do a recording at the Beatles Abbey Road Studios in London. And there's the most heartbreakingly delicious piece of video of Andre and his geezers, the guys who fought the good fight for years, turning up at Abbey Road and recording. And suddenly the door opens and in comes George Martin, the enabler of the Beatles. And they're just like you know, a religious figure has walked into the room. So that's got a very cute ending. The other major Soviet rock star who Art introduced me to was a guy called Boris Grebenchikov, who again was a middle class boy. He was some kind of electronic engineer, I think. But he was in St. Petersburg, which is a very different culture. The culture in Moscow is pretty straight on rock and roll. St. Petersburg is full of vaporous artists who play cellos and things in rock and roll bands. So that was a wholly different arrangement. I think Art always felt more comfortable with the St. Petersburg crowd. But one way or another, they soldiered on. And when tape recorders were made available, and strangely enough, the regime didn't really spot the seditious potential of reel-to-reel tape recordings. They just blew the kind of records on ribs, those things off the map, and people began to circulate cassettes and tapes all over the Soviet Union, and a band like Time Machine became absolutely huge, although they never had an official recording contract. It was all done by hand-to-hand tapes being passed around the place. And that slowly, over the years, evolved a very vital local rock and roll culture. Let's have a look now at the next clip, which is about every year Kolya Vasin does a birthday party for each of the Beatles. And this one is the Lennon party, which is on John's birthday. It's very interesting, actually, for the Russian fans. There's John Lennon, and then there's everybody else. He is the one. He is far and away the most revered of the Beatles. I asked Kolya Vasin, why was this? He said, for us, he's a Russian man. For us, his music is about pain, and we are about pain. So although they enjoy Paul McCartney and his pretty songs, the one who they really identify with is John. So here's the John Lennon birthday party mounted by Kolya Vasin in St. Petersburg.
For his John Lennon birthday party in St. Petersburg, Kolya Vasin has assembled a dozen tribute bands to play once again the music which seduced a generation.
Will you promise not to tell?
Almost 50 years after the Beatles virus first infected the Soviet Union, it lives on in the thousands of bands who still keep the faith and play the old songs.
You know you should be out.
I sometimes had a feeling on my journey that I was slipping in time, lost in an era which is hardly a memory back in my world. Being with that audience in St. Petersburg, it was obvious that the Beatles' songs still connect with kids as well as with their grandparents. But I kept remembering how tough it was for earlier generations to make this music their own.
Somebody said to me when I was in that audience, you are doing God's work, which is strange. And there is a real overlap for many of this generation between a kind of whacked out Christianity and worship of the Beatles. You can see a religion being born, especially around the figure of John Lennon. I mean, there's no question about it. I remember doing a film, incidentally, a few years back about the iconography of Che Guevara, and it's the same kind of smear between religious feeling, trapped religious feeling, and the cultural hero. Anyway, we now, I talked to a lot of people, obviously, over the years about what on earth was it about this blameless music from, you know, the Cold War enemy that made the party so very uneasy. And another friend of mine in Moscow, reporter called Vladimir Posner, said, you have to remember that the one thing those old guys in the Kremlin couldn't cope with was being laughed at. They simply couldn't deal with it. Also, they couldn't deal with something that seemed to have slipped out of their power. Couldn't really understand what it was, but they felt that it challenged them. And this is something that couldn't be allowed to happen. It was very heavily continued to be stamped down. I was, however, thrilled to discover that one of the Beatles' biggest fans in Moscow, who I interviewed, was a man called Sergei Ivanov, who is was his defense minister and is now a deputy premier of Russia. And I thought, I knew that he'd been at Paul McCartney's Red Square concert in 2003, and I thought I'd really, really like to interview him, and I thought, well, he's never going to do that. And he just got a note came back straight away, for the Beatles, anything. So we found ourselves in the Russian White House interviewing Mr. Ivanov, who was absolutely fascinating, and obviously a drooling fan of the Beatles. And he described how even when he was a kid in the early 60s, there were two worlds. There was the official world, and there's the world in which people actually lived, and they were very, very different, and the Beatles lived in the illicit world. I also talked to a guy who was a senior academic at the Institute of History in St. Petersburg, who said, you know, I can't overemphasize the impact of the Beatles. They, as he put it, helped to wash away the foundations of totalitarianism, and really healed the slave inside us, as he put it very, very memorably. That began to give me some indications of exactly what was happening here. As he said, what was taking place is that the generation who'd grown up listening to the music that their parents disapproved of and their political betters banned, just separated themselves from building socialism. They just decided that they would make a life in their own terms. And the gap, the next clip will take us into this, the gap between the between the regime and the old party structures and the Beatles generation just became, as we put it in the film, unbridgeable. Let's look at the next clip.
Thank you.
early 1980s, the gap between the Beatles' generation and their geriatric leaders had become unbridgeable.
As the huge country stagnated, millions of young people defected into their own world.
If we talk about the historical impact of the Beatles, they have alienated a whole generation of young, well-educated, urban Soviet kids from their communist motherland. They wanted to live in an alternative world, consuming alternative culture, pursuing alternative lifestyle. You are a stranger in your own country. You can live behind the Iron Curtain. You can pretend to be a young communist, but at the same time, you can be someone totally different.
Liberated by the Beatles, Soviet rock confronted the system. Viktor Tsoi's song, Changes, became an anthem for the early 80s. In March 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the Soviet leader. The man who would be called the USSR's first rock and roll president.
I always like to quote the words said by Mikhail Gorbachev. Quote, I do believe the music of the Beatles has taught the young generation of the Soviet Union that there is another life, there is freedom somewhere. And of course this feeling has pushed them towards perestroika, towards the dialogue with the outside world.
So those processes were going on as I worked and filmed in the former Soviet Union and in the satellite countries as well, from the 80s and into the 90s. And it was a fascinating thing and kind of unsettling thing to be there as this vast structure began to implode over those years. One of the incidental things that happened was that about 30 years late, the state began to issue Beatles albums. As somebody said, if you can't beat them, then try and make some money out of them. So they licensed Melodia, the state record label, licensed millions of copies of Sgt. Pepper and all the other things which had been unavailable until that point. As wonderful, this old bootlegger in St. Petersburg who actually managed to fit his own face onto the Sgt. Pepper album onto the cover alongside Kolya Vasin. Those processes obviously ebb and flow. You couldn't argue that Putin's Russia is exactly a Beatles liberated state. Far from it, very far from it. But the tensions which are exploding whenever they can on the streets of Moscow are very much powered up by this. I want to finish up by talking about the Pussy Riot affair, this group of women in St. Petersburg who, having done a fairly outrageous anti-Putin song in the big cathedral in Moscow, were promptly arrested and everybody thought, well, they'll be out in a few weeks, but only one of them is. They've become the focus for a repression that Artaudsky says it seems to him is more intensive than anything since the days of Stalin. It's very, very, very aggressive. And in fact, he's thinking he's going to have to leave the country. I'm quite concerned for him. He's very outspoken and they're giving him an increasingly hard time. 5 legal actions against him recently. As a rather sweet conclusion, Art decided that in order to support the Pussy Riot women, what the musical community could do was invite the bands to donate tracks of their music for a defense fund, for the Pussy Riot women. And very sweetly, one of the tracks that Art has garnered comes from Paul McCartney. So here we go, rocking the Kremlin one more time. That's where the story's up to right now. Thank you.
Dana, do you want to ask a question, given that you're our politics and dance person?
Yes, thank you. Actually, it's fascinating. I was wondering about, you were talking about living in two worlds, and I was wondering to what extent we need a third world, which is the world of the image that is aware of itself as an image. I mean, the Beatles were very different from other bands at the time, because they were the Beatles, and they had their image that they perpetrated. Do we need three worlds, perhaps, and maybe not just two worlds?
Yeah, probably we need a multitude of images and worlds. That's what having a somewhat free society is kind of supposed to be about. In this fractured mess that is current Russia, I think there's an absolute, an absolute clamour of images, possibilities. It hasn't all been stamped out by a very, very determined Kremlin. Somehow this genie hasn't been put back in the bottle, and I think you're right, a number of various images can now flourish, and indeed does flourish. Yeah.
Why the Beatles and why not Bob Dylan, the Stones, Elvis?
Good question. It seems that the Soviet and now Russian audiences have always been suckers for melody. That's been the thing that really... Remember that for the Russian fans, none of them could understand a word that the Beatles were singing. The lyrics were completely irrelevant. It was the sound, it was the melody. And of course, nobody writes better melodies than Paul McCartney. I think that... Art says that he reckons that every child of a certain era was conceived to a Paul McCartney record. It was immensely powerful. And what he also says is that the harsher rock of, say, the Rolling Stones or some of the or Little Richard was totally insane for to a Soviet ear. It really did sound wildly overdriven and very hard to receive, whereas very pretty melodies that the Beatles often came up with struck a chord for people. I think the Fab Four themselves also felt accessible in a way that the big American stars certainly didn't, and certainly black American stars, I don't even think about it, that's not where their comfort zone is. So I think that goes some way to explaining the extraordinary preeminence of the Beatles in all of that.
Did it matter that they were British?
No, I don't think so. It mattered that they were from the Cold War enemy in terms of its destructive force on the regime. Remember that for years the kids were told that the Cold War enemy are an enemy. Everything about them is appalling and it's out to kill you. Then they heard this music and they thought, that can't be right. It's coming from one of the countries that's trying to destroy us. It doesn't stack up. And there became, a disconnect between the propaganda and what they were hearing and experiencing. Oh, by the way, it's a wonderful question. Somebody at that John Lennon birthday party said to me, my nine-year-old kid just said to me, he's 9 years old, why is Yellow Submarine in English? Everybody knows the Beatles were a Russian group. Which is very interesting.
Paul.
I think the Russians did always admire the British, and they still do, although they don't like to admit it, since Peter the Great. Mm. So that might also be part of an answer. I want to ask you a question, and I also want to, if I might, tell a little story, because I'm quite moved, and I'll tell you why in a second. The question is, the answer to the question about why the Beatles you've given, but I think part of it was also that under Khrushchev's opening period, there was a bit of international youth identification. You showed some pictures of it. And so by 1961, when Brezhnev was trying to close the door, they'd somehow established some links across the world, and music was critical in the West, and this was a way of joining that kind of youth protest movement. I mean, in 68 happened in many Central European capitals as well as in the West. So I want you to comment on the kind of international youth uprising aspect of this, rock and roll as a protest and linking with the West and using that as part of being opposed to
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the curious thing about the Beatles being in the vanguard of promoting change is, of course, there's no overt politics at all in their music. They're inoffensive little 3 or 4 minute love songs. It was this, as somebody said to me thrillingly in St. Petersburg, the way the Beatles work for us was a bit like the way dogs and cats do. They don't know what we're saying, but they feel what we're feeling. And somehow that got through with the Beatles. And in terms of your question, it certainly got through with a generation that still calls itself the Beatles generation in Russia. There was a massive internationalization of the feeling that, I remember a guy in St. Petersburg saying to me, they made us feel here like we were connected with the world for the first time. We were part of that international youth thing that we'd barely been aware of, but now we were plugged into it. And this was hugely important and enormously liberating, and also encouraged people to turn aside from, you know, going to one more Young Pioneers meeting or whatever the regime was offering.
Yes, definitely.
Fascinating. Does it translate into political action? I mean, I'm of a similar generation of you, and I remember going to Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock, and how it was, you know, this was the Macmillan stupidity, let's move on.
Yeah.
That's a cultural thing, not a political thing.
Well,
you're suggesting this is going right into the politics.
I think so, but in ways that are really quite complex, I think. I mean, I'm a long way, I think, from suggesting that kids listened to Love Me Do and then dashed out into the street and pulled down the regime. It doesn't really work like that. It's the thing that many of my witnesses have been talking about changing, about neutralizing the fearful thing in your heart, freeing you up. Even if you can't take overt action, you no longer believe the crap that's being shoveled on you. You no longer sign on for the untruths which are being dumped on you by the generation. And that, I mean, if you it's so extraordinary that one of the people who was touched by that is Sergei Ivanov, hardly a pussycat, the man who was largely responsible for bombing Chechnya into the Stone Age. So obviously the lessons of Beatles music are somewhat ambiguous. It doesn't play out straight across. But nevertheless, there is, you're right, and there was an understanding in that generation of that global possibility. I mean, one of the things in my book, I try to talk a bit about what was going on in the other Soviet satellite countries, in East Germany and in Poland. And I actually went and spent some time in Belarus, a still absolutely unreformed, you know, Stalinist rump of the Soviet Empire. And there, where the repressions are at least as powerful as they ever were under Stalin, under the appalling Lukashenko, the music has become the main vehicle for opposition. It's very, very difficult because people finish up in jail or vanished very quickly. And one of the things that Lukashenko has done is to seize hold of the Belarusian entries to the Eurovision Song Contest. So they become politically very significant. They're, as you would imagine, all they do is sing songs of praise to, what do they call him, Daddy, they call Lukashenko. So you can see all of these things going on at the same time. I mean, you have the kind of geological layers from liberation to continuing repression going on at the same time. It's very interesting. One of the reactions that fascinated me was when Lenin was murdered. wailing and gnashing of teeth across the Soviet Union. And instantly, the party repositioned John as a heroic fighter for peace, an opponent of the Vietnam War, as one of us, as our kind of person, having spent the previous decade getting into this.
John,
I just worry a bit that Belarus gets more points than the European Socialists than the United Kingdom.
It really does. Yeah. But where have we gone wrong?
That's a worry, isn't it?
I don't think we have Lukashenko's control over the voters. that's not right.
Ross.
I just wanted to ask you something. It's International Women's Day today.
Yes.
And I was thinking about the Pussycat riots, and I was wondering whether there was any gender dimension to the thing, to what you've been talking about, whether this is a man's identification with the Beatles. Or, I mean, certainly we saw images of women enjoying the music, but that's a very familiar way of representing the Beatles.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point, and I always thought, well, you know, when I first started going to the Soviet Union, which was in the 80s, so it was hardly at the pinnacle of women's liberation in this country. It was indescribable there. I mean, Art Troitsky, who's a modern Russian man, I always thought was just unforgivable in the way that he dealt with his many, many women and his wife. But it wasn't a live issue. It is now, though. I mean, oddly enough, Art's first wife, who was very, very outspoken about these issues, was extremely interesting about the women's or the woman's perspective on Beatlemania. She said, when it worked like this, I had to decide, she said, when I was at school, whether to buy breakfast or a smuggled photograph of the Beatles. She speaks very intriguingly about the style dimension of the impact of the Beatles. They had whole armies of people taking boots, soldiers' boots, and turning them into Cuban Hill boots, or reconditioning John Lennon glasses from you know, conventional spectacles. But she makes it plain that I guess, unlike in the West, it was a much more male thing, the Beatles, than it was in many other parts of the world. For reasons I don't fully understand, except women didn't get much of a shot at anything in those years. They ran everything, but they didn't get much breathing space.
I was fascinated with the connection you made between John Lennon, Russia, and pain, particularly the Russian literature, I think. Is it possible to amplify that a bit? I mean, why did they pick on John Lennon in that role?
I think because his songs are often very anguished. Not perhaps his ones with the Beatles, but the ones that he's done since he left the Beatles are sometimes like, you know, an open razor blade being slashed across it. They're very, very agonized indeed, and they certainly tuned into that. I think they also had a feeling about John. They thought he was damaged, dangerous, edgy, all of which he was, and like that dog understanding the feeling, they really tuned into that in a major way, so that while they adored the pretty melodies, there was another thing going on with Lennon. There was a feeling that he was, Kolya Basin had a wonderful thing, he said that he's our giant and we're like Lilliputians running around his ankles. I didn't say that Kolya Basin's latest, I mean, he's lost most of his friends through this. He now is set about building a 300-foot-high memorial to John Lennon on the banks of the river, just outside St. Petersburg. I went with there and filmed him at this utterly scruffy place. I thought, how would that be? And he went into it. I can never quite work out with him whether he's insane or whether he's just having a laugh. He said, I shall sit on the top of this thing and I'll watch John rowing towards me from Liverpool. Now, it's both absurd, but also deeply felt at the same time.
Did he smoke dope there?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, you saw them in that little clip. Yeah. I'm not sure Kolya does, actually. He's just mad enough without the Doom.
Anybody else?
Yeah.
Music, and to what extent, which it obviously did, to what extent the Russian regime actually was aware of experiments, Timothy Leary, Ken Kesey type, the Mary Prankster type experiments going on in America?
Only to a tiny extent, I think. And then, I mean, remember there are two basic audiences. One is the sophisticated kids in New York and in Moscow and St. Petersburg and everywhere else. And most of the everywhere else's don't really figure in any of this. It's a very, very focused thing for the educated middle-class kids in Moscow and St. Petersburg and some other big cities. Yeah. But, you know, out there in the real Russia and with the mud and the cows and the... Mm. I have no idea how far these things penetrated. Although Arthur always said that rock and roll gave a generation a way to separate itself from the repressions of their parents. So some of it reached there. But remember, the records didn't really become available. The first Beatles record, I think, was the first time there was anything that was, though it wasn't acknowledged. One track, a very pretty little song called Girl, turned up on a collection of songs, I think in 77, and it was described on the label as English folk song, composer unknown. So, but the kids who knew exactly what it was, suddenly that was an electric shock because they realized that Beatles music could be officially acceptable, even though it hadn't even been acknowledged. So that really kicked the door open, that early evidence. And then Paul McCartney in 87, Otrutsky persuaded Paul to record an album just for the Soviet kids. And so he just spent 2 days bashing out some classic rock and roll things. And this album became, I mean, I remember a kid from Belarus telling me that he became a merchant seaman. And he found that this album wasn't available outside the Soviet Union. He made enough money selling contraband copies of this album to buy himself a Mercedes sports car and ship it back into his own country. So, you know, it's weird.
Thanks. I mean, it's a really interesting experiment on one level about the kind of emotional effect of politics of sound and music and rhythm and so forth. But I wondered whether it has encouraged you to think about the kind of depoliticization of music everywhere else.
Yeah.
That it's in this particular context that music has a certain kind of power where it rubs up against a very rigid structure of feedback.
Yes, exactly.
Raymond Williams' term. Has that changed your perception of the effect of the Beatles in this country, for instance, or elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the Beatles, at any evident level, didn't have an impact that you call directly political. It was enormous cultural impact, I think. But as part of the whole swill of things going on in the 60s, much of which, only some of which were musical, there were all kinds of things going on. I'm not familiar enough with the rock and roll of the 21st century to be able to know how much of it is overtly political. Some, I'm sure, is. A lot of it's not. But then, as you rightly observe, we don't have the same things to rub up against in a somewhat free society. The music doesn't have quite the same task. It's for going out and getting drunk on a Friday evening rather than for trying to change society for better and worse. I think for better, it's better to go and get drunk than feel you've got to struggle against your regime. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your talk. My question relates to your second to last answer. I was going to ask if any member of the group ever commented or acknowledged the fact they were having this momentous impact in the Soviet Union or elsewhere.
They didn't know. they had no idea. I mean, when Paul went and did his amazing concert in Red Square, if you ever see the video, it's just astonishing. It's a brilliant concert. And Art Rutsky said there were 100,000 people in tears in Red Square at that point. I mean, it's just an amazing scene.
What year was that?
2003. Mm-hmm. It's a galvanizing moment.
But at the point when he was asked to make to churn out the kind of stuff that became only a Russian.
Yeah, that was
in the late 80s.
Yeah.
So that about then he must have realized that it was.
Yes, they had. I don't think they. I mean, obviously, since he was talking to Art Rutsky by then, he was getting some insight. And probably of the ones who by then left alive, he might have been the only one who was interested.
Mm-hmm.
But they had I remember there's some stuff in that around, there's a very good documentary about Paul's concert, which maddeningly I missed, in which he says, only faintly were we aware of the dimensions of this. We knew that we'd had a certain kudos, but we hadn't realized that it had this potentially really seditious impact on a whole generation. I don't imagine Ringo cared very much, but Paul was intrigued enough and thoughtful enough to have been fascinated by it. And since, as I say, one of his friends had become Artemian Troitsky, he was given full evidence of this stuff, basically.
One last
question. Thank you. I thought that was very interesting. Thank you very much. I read some anecdotes about the exact same thing that you're describing here happening in Beijing, in China.
Yes.
Could you perhaps elaborate a little bit on if you know anything more about that?
You mean with the Beatles or with rock groups generally?
In rock groups generally, but
yeah, I don't think the Beatles registered in Beijing, but. The rock and roll rebellion in Beijing has been, as I understand it, genuinely significant. I mean, obviously, since it happened later there, it also overlapped with the internet generation, which changes everything. But I believe, again, the regime has struggled with the rock movement in Beijing. Although they're much, much smarter than the Soviets were, they know how to bend with the wind and adapt and embrace, rather as Brits might have done, or indeed did do. We're good at co-opting challenges. So yeah, I think it's, I don't know anything directly about it, but I believe it's of real significance.
Oh, you were going to tell a story, didn't you?
Yeah. Leslie, you've actually explained something that's been troubling me for a long time. I went in 1974 to Moscow on a language course. But I really went to
see what it was like.
See what it was like, and also to follow my then hero, I'm afraid, Trotsky. And I went around looking for him, knowing that he'd been airbrushed out of pictures and asking questions. And one day I decided not to go to the classes. We were very policed. And it was very organized. We ate in a huge restaurant where we had to wait 3 hours for a cold borscht. And I went off on my own and I walked around and I asked questions and I took photographs. And suddenly two men in very smart suits just picked me up and escorted me, and I was in the Lubyanka building.
Good God.
And I spent 6 hours being questioned, and it was good cop, bad cop. And I was quite nervous, but I was very proud to be a Brit because I felt that somehow protected me.
Did.
I was young, I was 18, so one could face anything. And I think quite soon they realized that I was just a bumbling British amateur, typical, wandering around, getting into trouble. And then at the end they said, look, we're going to let you go, but we have one very, very serious question for you. And we really want to listen. But before I ask the question, I will bring in all my colleagues, and they did. And they said, and so six of them came in, and they sat down, and I was quite nervous. And they said, now, will you explain why the Beatles broke up?
What year was that?
This is 1974.
That's fascinating.
And they were really interested, and they had a one-hour debate. And I wasn't. I mean, of course, I love the Beatles. Who doesn't?
Indeed.
And and it was my period and everything. But I wasn't an expert on the details of what happened about Let It Be and who. I knew, of course, that the people at Rowd. I knew about the girlfriends. I knew, about Yoko Ono. And they all blamed Yoko Ono.
Yeah, true.
And they said it's her fault. But as you said rightly, they loved John Lennon, so they were a bit kind of torn. And I had 1 hour, and then they said thank you very much, a little bit of a clap, and I was let out. And I've never quite, I can tell the story, it's a good dinner party story, but I've never quite understood it until today.
I wish, so that's a wonderful story, I wish I'd known about it, I'd put it in my book. That's fantastic. There you go.
Well, listen. That was really fascinating, really interesting, and I hope everyone will agree with me that it was well worth hearing Leslie and seeing the clips from the film. That was films was really great, and from Spy at age 18 to chronicler of the Beatles.
I always say about what I do, it's better than having a real job.
For those of you who are still looking for a real job, clearly. This is not going to be counted as one of them. You've had a really interesting life.
I have.
It's been really interesting.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sharing.
Fascinating. It's I'm just beginning to talk about the book, which is published in about a month's time. But I don't think I'll encounter a more responsive and interested audience than this anywhere.
You've got the cream of the crop. Thank you all.